Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is a very special one because it's episode number 200. Who would have thought that after 3 years, we would have this many episodes and this kind of following? Now, for those of you with me all the way and still around after the first 199 episodes, well, you're more than a trooper. For most of you in that category, we've essentially established a relationship. How could you listen to 200 episodes and not? Many of you have written to me, and over these 3 years of the podcast's experience, some of you have done it just once, just to express your appreciation most of the time, and some of the time just to ask a question. And then there are some more of you who have been interested in striking up a kinship. And when that happens, usually there's a bit of back and forth, and it's always fun. Not one of you has ever written in an unkind way, and always unique and individually interesting. Really, all of the stories that I have been told by all of you have had their own unique bit of wonderment in them. I try to write everyone back, and I'm not so timely lately, so one more time, sorry about that. I'll get to you, so please be patient. You see, it's because I went back to work full-time, at least for a while. And work must come first when you have such an obligation. When you have such a thing, you fulfill it. So lately, there have been less episodes and more work, and more, well, more up to until 3 a.m. in the morning nights in order to get the few episodes out that have come out since that pivot occurred. And why am I doing all-nighters? Because, frankly, I don't want to lose you as followers of the podcast. So that means there will be many more late nights just like that. We've both spent 3 years together, finding one another, reliving this story of the JFK assassination together, and occasionally me wandering off to tell you something publicly about my own life, or occasionally you privately telling me something about yours. And we're not done yet with this grand wander, so we both have to keep at it. Now that we're winding down the year 2023, taking in this last little bit of the 23rd year after the start of the new millennium, and doing what so many Americans and folks all around the world do at this time of the year, it's a season of the year that seems to foster a lot of love and a lot of laughter, perhaps some personal reflection, and for most of us, a good deal of happiness. And still for others, some sadness. And at least in my own case, a little bit of all of that. Look, I'm really blessed. I know that. But for each of us, life is never without its challenges. You all know some of mine. Over the course of 200 episodes, I've shared some. But isn't that table stakes for all of us to be in the game? Now, I'm thankful that I'm not in the middle of the Ukraine or Israel or engaged in a mortal struggle of any kind like that. That's a blessing no matter what day-to-day challenge you might be facing or first world problem you might have. There is, of course, always something to complain about if you choose to do so. One of the more salient traits of JFK was that he was not a complainer. He was a man who in later years suffered from terrible chronic pain, among other things. And he made it a point to never complain about it. He was almost famous for that, perhaps infamous now. There is a lesson to be learned there. As a man thinketh, they say, and I'm just saying. As the clock closes in on the 12 o'clock hour on the last day of December, I ask myself, my, Where did the year go? It went by so fast. We produced about 55 episodes this year of JFK, The Enduring Secret. A little less than prior years, but we still covered a lot of ground. And for me, as a cherry on top, I was able to attend the symposium, JFK at 60, put on at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh by Dr. Cyril Wecht and others. Many of you asked if I attended and wanted a little commentary from me on it. I haven't done that yet, so maybe now is the time to do it. At the symposium, I met perhaps the newest witness of fame, Paul Landis, the Secret Service agent who now claims that he found the magic bullet. Regardless of what you think of his book or what he said then or now, it's refreshing that an 88-year-old guy who has stayed inside, so to speak, and away from the limelight, would finally get out and make the rounds. But there was much more than that. The presenters there were the top-notch folks in this field. I was privileged to meet and talk with and listen to the lectures of some of the most esteemed individuals in the world doing JFK assassination research. The likes of Josiah Thompson, Doug Horn, David Mantic, James DiEugenio, John Newman, and Jefferson Morley, and a number of others from the research community. Some of those names you may very well hear on upcoming episodes of mine. And I also was able to meet up with newer, emerging names on the topic, wonderful individuals like Matt Crumpton, whose show, Solving JFK, is perhaps the best new podcast out there on the same topic, and Andrew Eiler, who is, in my opinion, the foremost technical legal expert on the law of the JFK Records Act, bar none. Those are two folks that we have already done shows with and that we will have with us soon on JFK, The Enduring Secret. And it was more than a treat to spend some time with Dr. Cyril Wecht himself, a man I have met before, corresponded with, and spent private time with on several occasions. This is a conference event that only happens once a decade. This year, the year of the 60th anniversary, Dr. Wecht, who has forever been the iron warrior in the pursuit of truth, is finally beginning to show his age. Almost 90 years old now, his health is declining, but his mind is still sharp. And in a tearful goodbye of sorts delivered by the audience, Wecht remained pensive and stoic as Dr. Wecht himself, one evening during the conference, was given a lifetime award. And as only he could deliver it, in his acceptance speech, he acknowledged that this might be his last conference and asked that we all carry on the good fight to find the truth. None in the room at that moment, including myself, could resist the request of this old warrior to do just that. So in my heart, I signed up for more. I'll do my part with the time and the reach that I personally have left. At that same meeting, there was young blood in the room, too. A young man with an engineering degree and a penchant for the case explained how he and his wife are putting together a 3D model of Dealey Plaza. And it won't be long until we can all roam around in the model and conduct physical experiments that address things like angle of shot and trajectory of bullets and position of hypothetical shooters, something researchers have only done in person at the plaza for the most part up to this point, save a few isolated exceptions. Thanks to the pick and spade work of this young researcher, which included many days spent in Dealey Plaza with a drone and special software and camera equipment, well, the democratization of this information is now likely to occur. And when it does, it will add a new 20th century high-tech dimension to the ongoing forensic work surrounding the case. The work was inspired by the recent public movement in Dallas to renovate Dealey Plaza and remake its face, removing the look of 1963. Overtly or covertly, as you may see it. That's right, erase the face of history. some would liken the moment as going to Washington and tearing down Ford's Theater, where Abraham Lincoln was shot. Why Dealey Plaza does not have the same historical significance and distinction as Ford Theater does is a curious fact that we should all scrutinize more closely. But thanks to a new generation of citizen researchers, preservation of it in an important way is going to be achieved. The keynote speaker was Alec Baldwin, and as much as I like him playing Trump on Saturday Night Live, I liked him even more when he delivered a speech that was thoughtful, intelligent, and impressive. He is an inspiring public figure that truly understands the details of the case itself and the ramifications to our model of government that the Kennedy case continues to have. He is a spokesman and an advocate who is so well known publicly that he could also legitimately relate to the audience what happens when you speak about this topic and you are as well known in the entertainment industry as Alec Baldwin is. Everyone who is a public figure pays some sort of price for doing that, at least when the narrative is in a direction other than a lone gunman. Some of you have asked what I learned at the conference that was noteworthy. Well, I learned a lot from all those that I mentioned above, but here are a few tidbits. One was a casual conversation with Dr. David Mantic, who gave me a better understanding of why parts of the president's skull blew out that weren't exactly in the line of fire. And that's a curiosity that my own common sense and, I guess, lack of medical knowledge has heightened over the years. Well, it was a discussion around the expulsion of energy that seeks the easiest exit, and that the top of the head is the portion of the skull that is the most vulnerable for this. Well, the light bulb went on as Dr. Mantic explained in a simple and eloquent, impromptu medical explanation. That day's attendance yielded more than I expected. Jim DiEugenio's discussion of the wider geopolitical framework of that time was spectacular and helps us all to understand that things never happen in a vacuum. And Doug Horne's and David Mantic's presentation of the doctoring of the Zapruder film was stimulating. I have been a skeptic for a long time on that one, but the discussion was compelling, and listening to them in person discuss the topic and present evidence, well, the candid discussion of it seemed to sear into my own head and deserves a follow-up episode as a supplement to all the Zapruder episodes that I did in the first year of the podcast. Episodes where I completely sidestepped some of the key findings of the ARRB related to chain of custody of the film and its diversion to Rochester. So that original mulligan of mine will be rectified before we finish the journey. And if we get lucky, Doug Horne will be on the show sometime in the spring. Perhaps early spring if we get luckier. And Jim DiEugenio has also agreed to come on to the show for perhaps several dedicated episodes. And if it were not for my own bloody schedule, we would have produced them already. All of these will be exciting adds in 2024. Perhaps the most refreshing thing for me at the meeting was the serendipitous chance to meet up with a few of you that have listened to the podcast and are followers of JFK, The Enduring Secret. One more kindred spirit of connection that went from the ethereal existence that was born on the airwaves to a real-life interaction at the conference. Jet fuel for a podcaster like me. Well, that wander is over. You know, nostalgia takes the stage at this time of the year, and wanders are many, always. But always, we get down to the business of storytelling here at JFK, The Enduring Secret. So here we go. I'm not sure whether this is going to be the last episode of the year, but because it is episode number 200, it seems fitting to have a little celebration and also to do just that, to cap off 2023 with this most important. But you never know. I may still find the time for number 201 as well before I close the door on 2023. Keep your eyes and ears peeled. So it's fitting that today's episode, as we barrel towards New Year's Eve, is an episode about a party, or at least about partying, so to speak. Today's episode covers one of the most controversial moments in the history of JFK and the Secret Service. The night before his assassination, a group of Secret Service agents go out on the town in Fort Worth, headed first to the Fort Worth Press Club, and then to a nightclub named The Cellar. Most of the agents who went back to the hotel were out quite late, well after 3 in the morning, and at least one of those agents, Paul Landis, by some accounts, made his way back to the hotel around 5 a.m., hardly getting any sleep before he had to get up and guard the president and Jacqueline Kennedy. Hardly a responsible thing to do. On the eve of one of the most important presidential protection assignments given the Secret Service during the second half of the 20th century. The ramifications of this behavior are many. What went on the night before almost assuredly affected the performance of the Secret Service the next day when guarding the president. And the fact that they would even engage in such things opens up a wider question of the culture of the Secret Service at the time and how the culture itself contributed to the result in Dallas on November 22nd. So now let's listen to the rest of episode 200 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. You know, as simple as this story may seem, right? A bunch of guys go out the night before and stay out too late and drink too much. And that causes their physical reactions to be less than capable. And they do it in the context of being on one of the most important assignments of their life. Well, that may be just it. But sometimes you find a little bit of a story that sets the backdrop better than that. So I'm going to read you one from Newsweek. This piece by author Susan Cheever and Michael Falco gives more richness and context to the circumstance. I'm going to read to you now portions of that Newsweek opinion. A week after the events in Dallas, President Lyndon Johnson ordered the first official investigation of the assassination. And who was its chairman? Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who had had a distinguished career as the governor of California. The Warren Court, during his 14 years as Chief Justice, had heard many pivotal cases, including Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, with its landmark civil rights decision. With an already established reputation and an eye on the political thicket that would surround an investigation into Kennedy's assassination, Warren hesitated to accept Johnson's mandate. Johnson prevailed. 3 days after reluctantly taking the job, Warren learned that Secret Service agents had been out on the town, socializing and drinking until early morning, the day of the assassination. The revelation came not from depositions, but from a radio report, followed up by a December 2nd newspaper column in the Washington Post by Drew Pearson, the establishment journalist and close friend of Chief Justice Warren, well known for speaking truth to power. Pearson wrote that the Secret Service agents had visited the Fort Worth Press Club after midnight, and that 6 of them had proceeded to an offbeat place called the Cellar Coffee House. Some of the agents were out until nearly 3 a.m., and one of them was reported to have been inebriated, Pearson wrote. Pearson explained that his information had come to him through Thayer Waldo, a Fort Worth Star-Telegram reporter who didn't think his editors would dare publish a story casting aspersions against Secret Service men. The Warren Commission duly questioned the Secret Service agents in question about their activities the night before the assassination and found that they had been drinking. But in the 1960s, the pastime of drinking with peers or colleagues was considered normal, acceptable behavior in many circles. Because of the lack of social stigma associated with drinking, it was hard for the panel's members to know how to react. Philadelphia Assistant District Attorney Arlen Specter, who had reluctantly taken the Warren Commission job, and who debriefed the agents for the Warren Commission, didn't consider their behavior a severe problem. Indeed, the agents themselves were already devastated by their failure to protect the president, who most of them had revered. Although the agents had broken the rules, many involved with the commission were eager to protect them from going down in history as the men who had made the mistakes that may have doomed the president. Chief Justice Earl Warren, however, was outraged. His ire finally found a voice in June 1964 when the commission questioned James Rowley, the director of the Secret Service. Under oath, Rowley admitted that Drew Pearson's column had been more or less accurate. Some had been drinking scotch, others two or three beers. After forcing Rowley to read the agency's regulations that, and I quote, "the use of intoxicating liquor of any kind is prohibited," General Counsel J. Lee Rankin hammered him. Even though drinking was a firing offense, according to the manual, Rowley had fired no one. "How can you tell," Rankin asked, "that the men's actions the night before had nothing to do with the assassination?" Rowley bobbed and weaved. He had thought about punishment, he admitted. On the other hand, he had not wanted to blame the agents for the assassination. He did not want to stigmatize them or their families. These answers seemed to infuriate Warren. "Don't you think that if a man went to bed reasonably early and hadn't been drinking the night before, he would be more alert than if he stayed up until 3, 4, or 5 o'clock in the morning, going to beatnik joints and doing some drinking along the way?" Warren noted that some citizens along the route of the motorcade waiting for the president to pass by had actually seen a gun barrel pointed out of the 6th-floor window of the Texas School Book Depository. None of the Secret Service agents had noticed it. "Some people saw a rifle up in that building," Warren went on. "Wouldn't a Secret Service man in this motorcade, who is supposed to observe such things, be more likely to observe something of that kind if he was free from any of the results of liquor or lack of sleep than he would be otherwise? Don't you think that they would have been more alert, sharper?" Long work shift and a tolerance for partying and drinking had become entrenched in the Secret Service. Agents acknowledged that the Secret Service's socializing intensified each year of the Kennedy administration, to a point where, by late 1963, a few members of the presidential detail were regularly remaining in bars until the early morning hours. Investigative journalist Seymour M. Hirsch would note in his book, The Dark Side of Camelot. Hirsch reported that things were so loose that at least three of the Kennedy women, sisters and cousins from the president's large family, had propositioned various agents. All of this rule-breaking behavior among members of the extended Kennedy family should have made the Secret Service more alert and more responsible. Instead, it seemed to have just the opposite effect. Whether or not they were hungover on November 22nd, several agents were certainly sleep-deprived, a not uncommon state among Secret Service men at the time. Agent Gerald Blaine, also in the Dallas motorcade, remembered struggling to stay awake on numerous occasions and spoke of being afraid to sit down or lean against a wall lest he nod off. Working double shifts had become so common since Kennedy became president that it was now almost routine. 3 8-hour shift rotations operated normally when the president was in the White House, but when he was traveling, there simply weren't enough bodies. Not only did many agents lack sleep, they rarely had time to eat. In his flight bag, along with extra ammunition and shoe polish, Blaine typically kept a few bags of Planters peanuts, sometimes the only thing he ate all day. "Motorcades were the Secret Service's nemesis," Agent Gerald Blaine would write. "They were an endless number of variables, and you could never predict how a crowd would react. In Dallas, against department regulations, the president and the vice president, Lyndon Johnson, would ride in the same motorcade, making the situation even more unstable in the eyes of the men there to keep them from harm." President John F. Kennedy traveled more than any previous president. and traveling with the president when it involved the first lady and other eminent guests and their families always became more of a challenge. Kennedy wanted to be physically close to his constituents. All of this created a recipe for disaster in Dallas. Two days after the first anniversary of the assassination, on November 24th, 1964, an article would appear in the San Francisco Chronicle. The headline was simple but powerful. The Secret Service Chief Backed Men. Secret Service Chief James J. Rowley concedes that 10 of his men violated regulations the night before President Kennedy was assassinated, but he did not punish them for fear it would place an undeserved stigma on them. Rowley came to their defense in June 18th testimony before the Warren Commission made it public yesterday. He said the men violated Secret Service rules by drinking at the Fort Worth Press Club and visiting a beatnik night spot there during the early morning hours of November 22nd. He said four of the men involved were assigned to the follow-up car behind Mr. Kennedy during the Dallas motorcade. And there, all told, Rowley said, nine men went to the press club and 10 men went to a Fort Worth night spot called the Cellar, which did not serve alcoholic beverages. Chief Justice Earl Warren asked Rowley whether agents who were not affected by liquor or lack of sleep the night before would not have been more likely to spot a man with a rifle in a window overlooking the motorcade. Well, yes, he would be, Rowley replied. Don't you think that they would have been much more alert, sharper, had they not been doing these things? Warren persisted. Yes, sir. But I don't believe they could have prevented the assassination, the Secret Service chief said. Rowley said the infractions were investigated, but that no disciplinary measures were taken against the agents involved. Well, he said, I did consider what type of punishment would be provided. Then I also considered that these men in no way had, their conduct had no bearing on the assassination. And therefore, I thought that in the light of history, to place a stigma on them by punishing them at that time, from which inevitable the public would conclude that they were responsible for the assassination of the president, I didn't think this was fair. And that they did not deserve that with their family and children. Pat Kirkwood was a well-known name in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in the 1960s. He was, among other things, the owner of the Cellar. The Cellar had been described in so many ways, and often it's thought of as the scene of counterculture. It played rock music at night, which in the 60s was a ticket that assured a counterculture reputation. You could not legally serve alcohol in the club, but there was plenty of drinking there, with booze most assuredly served under the table after you had purchased a setup. Occasionally, they would be subject to a raid and a few arrests of the barmaids or bartenders that worked there. Others would simply call the Cellar a hippie-style coffee house for beatniks, where rock music and poetry would flow. One thing is for sure, it was not your typical bar that you might find in a Texas town full of cowboys, or even a Texas town without many cowboys. Pat Kirkwood had some colorful characters as friends and perhaps had more than one dubious friend in one place or another, including inside the mob. Kirkwood was said to have been a friend of Jack Ruby. At one time, Kirkwood was also a stock car racer. You are beginning to get the picture. It's hard to find material on the story of the Cellar. A man named Arvel J. Strickland claimed to have been there that night, the night the Secret Service agents were there. He was essentially a member of one of the bands that played there. Supposedly, he is quoted as saying, many people have heard the Cellar name in connection with the Kennedy Secret Service agents. Well, I was there that night, but also a few nights previous when an NBC camera crew did some filming there. If you have seen a 6-part documentary entitled The Men Who Killed Kennedy, you've seen me. I'm the guitar player you saw for 3 or 4 seconds as the camera panned past the bandstand, along with, on bass, C.B. Oliver, and on drums, Felix Vasquez. Sound interesting? Well, I was curious, too, about his story, but the link to his own website was removed by the time I caught up with it on the Education Forum. When you think of the story of the cellar, you think of the tale of two cities, one being told by the Secret Service agents themselves and their supporters, and one being told by their critics. If you listen to the Secret Service agents, they ended up at the cellar in the early morning hours of November 22nd to get something to eat, and not so much to drink. If you listen to the critics, the story is quite different. So who really to believe? Well, before we pass judgment, let's begin to tell the story. Jeb Byrne was an advance man for the Kennedy administration's trip to Fort Worth. In a history of some of his experiences during the advance activities in Fort Worth, he would write this. While I was engaged with my set of problems, Duncan, Hall, and Howard went about their business of providing for the safety of the president while he was in Fort Worth. They met with law enforcement agencies that would be involved in the visit. They checked the backgrounds of hotel employees and others who would be in close contact with the presidential party. They ran out and timed motorcade routes and alternatives, made arrangements for tight security on the president's quarters in the hotel, and they went through the numerous other rituals peculiar to their calling. That night, we met to compare notes. I also took the time to walk around downtown Fort Worth and get the feel of the city. On one walk, enticed by a sale, I entered a hat store and came out with a Stetson. I tried to appear accustomed to wearing this Western headgear, but probably fooled no one. On my rambles, I dropped in twice to the cellar, a below-the-street place near the hotel, where strange drinks without alcohol were served to the heavy thrum of drums and guitars. The preferred dress style was 1960s beatnik, and the den did not encourage lengthy stays by visitors with unconditioned ears. I went to bed, declining an invitation to visit the Fort Worth Press Club, which was staying open late for the benefit of visiting journalists. Just as well. Among those who did go to the press club were some off-duty members of the Secret Service who had just arrived from Washington. A few also visited the cellar, the aforementioned night spot. After the Dallas catastrophe, they were pilloried by Drew Pearson, one of the most influential syndicated columnists of the day, for drinking and keeping late hours on a presidential trip. However, there was no evidence at all of extensive drinking by agents of the Secret Service. As one agent told me, they were much more interested in getting a bite to eat than a drink. Meals for Secret Service agents on presidential trips could be erratic. Well, thank you, Jeb Byrne. A bite to eat, you say? Sounds like an Ozzie and Harriet episode. Maybe it was just that. Or maybe not. Well, you want to hear what the cellar was really like for the average person who dropped in there? Well, I'll read you this post from the Education Forum that had a link. It's now expired, but the original story remains. But I believe it's from the Texas Historical Association. The cellar was one of the most unusual clubs in Texas. It was owned by Pat Kirkwood and managed by Jim Hill. Four cities had a cellar: Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas, and San Antonio. The club appeared on the Texas music scene beginning about 1958, first in Fort Worth and then in Houston. These two cities were the most successful locations. The San Antonio cellar lasted only a few weeks in late 1962, and the Dallas location was never as busy as the first two. The original cellar in Fort Worth opened on Houston Street about 1958. It was subsequently moved several times in the early 1960s. House bands rotated periodically from one cellar to another. Rockabilly musician Johnny Carroll served as music director for the original cellar and each subsequent cellar thereafter. All the clubs had the same format. Each night, after an evening performance by an individual from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., two paid bands played alternate one-hour sets from 8 p.m. until 5 a.m. in the morning. This was before liquor by the drink was passed in Texas, so no alcohol was served, just setups. The cover charge was $1. For that small price, a customer could hear two bands and watch the pretty waitresses. They wore bikinis, serve Cokes all night long. Another unique feature was that there was no dance floor. The space in front of the stage was covered with old couch cushions where the clientele could lie down and listen to the music. The rest of the club was filled with tables and sofas, which lined the walls. The lack of dancing encouraged the customers to listen, and the music was great. Bands played cutting-edge rock, blues, R&B, country rock, and the Beatles, mixed with their own originals. There was also a 2-foot-high and a 2-foot-wide partition separating the band from the sofa cushion area. This was often used as a runway by female dancers who sometimes stripped spontaneously. Stripping was not legal in the cellar, but it wasn't the only shady thing going on. The cellar also later had the dubious distinction of being frequented by rival club owner Jack Ruby, who killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Secret Service agents patronized the club on the night before the Kennedy assassination. The cellar had an undertone of violence. 5 or 6 bouncers were usually on hand to throw out anyone who passed out on the cushions. A side door that opened onto the street was the portal used, and the bouncers would really rough people up badly. To keep anyone not welcome in the club from getting in and to break up fights, of which there were many, some instigated by the bouncers, and to protect the waitresses and musicians. On stage, above the musicians, out of sight of the audience, were 3 bulbs in a row, 1 white, 1 blue, and 1 red. The white meant that all was okay. The blue meant that the police were in the club, so performers had to watch their language and behavior. And the red meant to start playing a song immediately and continue playing until the light went out. The music was meant to distract the audience from a fight. Since all the cellars were in rough parts of town, some of the bouncers' actions were justified, though fighting was a poor fit with the hippie attitudes in the music scene at the time. Nevertheless, the main focus of the cellar was music. Dusty Hill, Frank Beard of ZZ Top, and Rocky Hill had a band called the American Blues, and they had blue hair. Other groups, the Cellar Dwellers, the Neurotic Sheep, the Geeks, were made up of great session players from around town who could play any type of music. The Cellar Dwellers' repertoire, for example, included Beatles covers. The various locations of the cellar began to close in the mid-1970s, mainly because of the legalization of liquor by the drink and the rise of clubs with light shows and long jams catering more to young music fans. The cellar was a strange mix of old-style club management and the innovative music of the 60s and the 70s. It was a place to hear hours of music for just a dollar with no boundaries on style or genre, and it was a great training ground for young musicians tough enough to survive all the strange things going on around them. Cellar music director Johnny Carroll died in 1995, and owner Pat Kirkwood died in 2000. You know how much I like to play characters, and you know how much I like to read the transcripts from the original record. James Rowley's testimony in front of the Warren Commission that day in June 1964 covers a lot of ground, and it's 30-plus pages long. too much to include in its entirety in the podcast. And the highlights are mostly that Earl Warren got after him in one of those few topics related to the tragedy that Warren truly got passionate about. He viewed the drinking incident as despicable, and the fact that the men involved were not disciplined, well, he viewed that as a true error in judgment. Most of that has already been portrayed in today's episode in various ways, but there is a section of Raleigh's interrogation that I would like to recreate here now, verbatim, using computer-generated voices to help me. It reinforces the ire of the Commission's General Counsel, Lee Rankin, on the very same subject, and a bit, too, of the Chief Justice. And it demonstrated the bob and weave that Secret Service had James Raleigh engaged in regarding the whole topic. It's not the most famous section of this interrogation, but it's important and interesting enough. And what perhaps is more relevant is that there is something more to it. You see, this first conversation that you are about to hear led into a second discussion, a discussion that you will also hear, a discussion regarding the Abraham Bolden matter. So, we are going to recreate both of those portions of the testimony as well. It serves to reinforce that Bolden was likely telling the truth. That is, that he attempted to testify before the Warren Commission on the nature of this very topic, that he had witnessed terrible insubordination and intoxication of Secret Service agents during his rotation as part of the White House Secret Service detail. And he was rebuffed from doing so. And it calls into question whether Rowley asserted that day, during his own testimony, nothing less than a bold-faced lie about Bolden. No pun intended. Saying unequivocally that Bolden had never communicated any of this information up through the chain of command prior to the president's assassination. Well, whether it was a bold-faced lie or simply the active deployment of plausible denial, we may never know the full truth. But what we do know is that Bolden did make attempts to tell his story, and it was quashed. And eventually, it led to him being framed, an assertion he was already making loudly enough that Chief Rowley mentions just that in his own testimony about it. You will hear that today from Rowley, that Bolden was asserting that he was framed. And of course, we all know how that story ended. He was indeed framed to shut him up. So stay tuned over the next few minutes as we bring to you these two sections of Rowley's testimony, verbatim testimony using computer-generated voices of these portions of the investigation.
Hello, my voice today will portray the voice of J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel for the Warren Commission and the individual who interrogated Secret Service Chief James Raleigh in what you are about to hear.
Hello, my voice today will portray the voice of James Raleigh, the chief of the Secret Service, in what you are about to hear, which is his interrogation in front of the Warren Commission.
Hello, my voice today will portray the voice of Chief Justice Earl Warren of the Warren Commission as he participates in the interrogation of Secret Service Chief James Raleigh.
Did you learn in connection with the trip when the assassination occurred that certain of the Secret Service agents had been in the press club and what is called the cellar at Fort Worth the night before?
Well, that came to my attention through a broadcast that Mr. Pearson made, that the agents were inebriated the night before at the Fort Worth Press Club. I immediately dispatched Inspector McCann to Fort Worth to investigate the report and to interview the agents.
What did you learn?
I learned that there were 9 agents involved at the press club. And I might say this, the agents on duty throughout the day had no opportunity to eat. When they arrived at Fort Worth, they were informed that there was a buffet to be served at the Fort Worth Club. This is what I ascertained in personal interviews. Upon going over there, they learned there was no buffet, and some of them stayed for a drink. 3, I think, had 1 scotch, and others had 2 or 3 beers. They were in and out from the time they arrived, I would say roughly around 12:30, until the place closed at 2 o'clock. Now, after that, some of them went to the cellar. This is a place that does not serve alcoholic beverages. They went there primarily, I think, out of curiosity, because this was some kind of a beatnik place where someone gets up and recites, or plays the guitar.
Did you learn whether or not there were any violations of the regulations of the Secret Service by these men?
There was a violation. At that time there was a section in our manual in effect that said that during...
Will you give us first the number?
Section 10.
Is that Chapter 1, page 7?
Chapter 1, page 7, yes, sir.
Now, will you tell the commission about what the regulation was?
The use of liquor. Employees are strictly enjoined to refrain from the use of intoxicating liquor during the hours they are officially employed at their post of duty or when they may reasonably expect that they may be called upon to perform an official duty. The one that applies here, however, all members of the White House detail and special agents cooperating with them on presidential and similar protective assignments are considered to be subject to call for official duty at any time while in travel status. Therefore, the use of intoxicating liquor of any kind, including beer and wine, by members of the White House detail and special agents cooperating with them or by special agents on similar assignments, while they are in a travel status, is prohibited.
Can you tell the commission how many men were involved in these trips to the press club and the cellar, where these things were done?
There were 9 men involved at the press club, and there were 10 men involved at the cellar.
How many men, of those 10 men, were in the presidential motorcade on the day of the assassination?
4 men were in the follow-up car.
Who are they?
Do you know their names?
Yes, Landis, Hill, Reddy, and Bennett.
Did you make any investigation to determine whether or not their violation of the Secret Service regulations had anything to do with the assassination of the president?
Yes. They performed their duties from the time they departed in the follow-up car from Love Field until the point of the tragedy in a most satisfactory manner. There was nothing deficient in their actions or their alertness. They went through the heaviest part of downtown Dallas, through the crowds, and performed in an exemplary manner.
How do you know that?
From the reports that I got from their superiors.
In the work that you did with the White House detail before you became chief of the Secret Service, did you know the various responsibilities of the members of the White House detail?
Yes, sir.
Did you ever participate in such motorcades yourself?
I have, yes, sir.
How much?
Well, I have participated, in rough numbers, over a period of 22 years roughly, maybe, 1,000 or more.
Will you briefly describe the functions of the Secret Service agents in connection with the president's car?
Have you finished this other matter? All right. Go right ahead.
When the president's car leaves the airport or a railroad station or any other location, the agents accompany him to the car and stand to the right and left, in the same order as their designated positions on the follow-up car, and screen him. And then the car moves out, slowly, because the rest of the cars have to have an opportunity to follow in the motorcade, so that none lingers behind, or is left behind. And then the agent in the lead car determines that the motorcade is intact and is moving, then he steps up his speed, which is a cue to the presidential driver to step up his speed, and then they go at a speed consistent with the crowd that is there, and so forth. So, upon leaving the airport, if there is a huge crowd there, the men are still on the ground running on the right and left side of the president, both rear and front of the vehicle. After they get out of the crowd, then the men in the front beside the presidential vehicle drop back and take their positions in the follow-up car. This is so that they are not in the way of the men running on the right and left rear. They move back last and have a clear opportunity to jump on board the follow-up car in the event the speed of the motorcade is stepped up. When the motorcade comes to intersections or turns, which are always vulnerable points, in that if you make a right turn, that is the closest point for someone to come out, the agents on the right side before reaching that point, will jump off, to be available alongside the president's car in the event someone darts out with some malicious plan. There have also been times when, innocently, ladies and young people will come out to throw a bouquet of flowers. And then if there is a crowd that is sparse, they return to their position in the follow-up car. When they come into a big crowd, they take it on foot, and at a little jog, if necessary. In some instances, if the crowd continues for a prolonged distance, the agents work together. In other words, there are rear steps on the right and left rear of the presidential car with handrails. These have two purposes. 1, for agents to ride on and to screen the president from anything from above, in a situation like this, to keep an additional man available in case of trouble, and also to alternate with the men to the right rear of the president, who are jogging along warding off the crowd.
What positions did the 4 men that you refer to, who went to the press club and the cellar matter, occupy on the day of the assassination?
Well, Mr. Reddy occupied the right front, Mr. Landis to his rear.
What do you mean by right front?
Right front running board position of the follow-up car. It was his responsibility or duty to jump off in crowds and to take the position at the right rear of the president's car. Mr. Landis, if necessary, to jump off if the occasion demanded and take the right front of the president's car. Mr. Hill was on the left front running board of the follow-up car, and his responsibility was at the rear of the president's car. His position was assigned there because he was in charge of the first lady's detail, and she was seated on the left side. And Mr. McIntyre was to his rear on the left running board. So his assignment would have been up to the left front of the president's car. Mr. Bennett was in the rear seat of the follow-up car.
How can you tell that the fact that they were out a night before and violated the regulations had nothing to do with the assassination?
Well, based on the reports of my investigating agents and the facts as to how they performed at the time of the tragedy. Mr. Hill, who was on the left side, responded immediately as he looked toward the presidential car. Being on the left side, he scanned from left to right, and when he saw there was something happening to the president following a noise, he immediately jumped from his position to get aboard from his side. Mr. Reddy scanned to the right, so he was looking away from the president, because he was looking round from the right side. As a consequence, he wasn't aware of what was happening in the front. The car was also going on a turn at that time.
What about the other two?
The other two were watching. They reacted normally. The man on the left side looked to his left rear, and the man, Landis, looked to his right rear.
Have you done anything to discipline these men for violation of the regulations of the Secret Service?
Well, I did consider what type of punishment would be provided. Then I also considered the fact that these men in no way had their conduct had no bearing on the assassination. And, therefore, I thought that in the light of history, to place a stigma on them by punishing them at that time, from which inevitably the public would conclude that they were responsible for the assassination of the president, I didn't think this was fair, and that they did not deserve that, with their family and children.
How do you construe subparagraph C of your Regulation 10 regarding the use of alcoholic liquors?
Will you read it for the record?
Will you kindly read it?
Violation or slight disregard of the above paragraphs or the excessive or improper use of intoxicating liquor at any time will be cause for removal from the service. In interpreting the words excessive and improper, slight evidence tending to indicate unusual or questionable conduct will be considered proof that the use of liquor has turned improper or excessive. Association with others who drink to excess will be considered as an indication of using more than a moderate amount of liquor. The excuse that liquor was used for medicinal purposes will not be accepted.
How do you construe and apply that?
Well, in this instance, it was wrong.
Were these men under this regulation considered to be on travel status? So that they should not be using intoxicating liquor?
Yes, sir.
There is no question about that in your mind?
No, sir.
Has anything been done to reprimand and cause them to realize that this is a violation of your regulations?
They were interviewed by the inspector at the time. The seriousness of the matter was impressed upon them. And I think they recognized the seriousness of their acts. The men we recruit are men that are college graduates and mature, and we screen them very carefully, particularly after we assign them to the White House detail. They know and we know that they are in a fishbowl, 24 hours a day. And that, therefore, their conduct is always subject to scrutiny, and so forth, and that they are responsible individuals. Their records have indicated that they have been performing in a high degree. They have worked endless hours of overtime. They are dedicated. And if they were not, they would not be on the detail. They realize the seriousness of the violation. And I went over it with my special agent in charge. He understands it. And I am quite sure that they all understand it at this time.
I would like to have you examine Commission Exhibit Number 1018, Chief Rowley, and see if that is the regulation of the Secret Service that you have been referring to.
Yes, that is what I have been reading here, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to offer as a part of the record the regulation, Commission Exhibit 1018.
It may be admitted.
The document was marked for identification as Commission Exhibit Number 1018, and received in evidence.
Chief Rowley, Have you had any other complaints similar to this in regard to the conduct of the Secret Service agents on the presidential or White House detail?
We had one in the last month. We had charges leveled at us by an agent of the Secret Service, Mr. Rankin.
Will you tell us about that?
Who is currently under indictment, and who will be brought to trial on criminal charges on the 29th of June. And, for that reason, while I have no reluctance to discuss it, I think we should go off the record, because I don't want to in any way prejudice the case.
There is no reason to discuss that case here, Chief. Is there anything in particular that would affect this situation you wanted to know our hat, Mr. Rankin?
Mr. Chief Justice, the only thing would be the investigation as to whether or not there was comparable conduct. I didn't know whether the Commission would like to know what that investigation was and what the results of it were.
Well, I suppose there is no objection to the Chief telling us what this complaint was, but not insofar as it hears on the crime that he is charged with.
Well, it ties in with the crime, because he said he was framed. Now, he said he was framed because he was prepared to go before your Commission, sir, to testify about this thing that happened 3 years ago, and in the charges he said he advised me, as well as others, and nothing was done. He said he was framed for this reason.
Had he ever made any complaint to you before?
He had never made any complaint to me. It came as a complete surprise. Representative Ford, the complaint to you came subsequent to the filing of criminal charges against him? He said he had made the charges at the time the alleged incidents occurred, Mr. Congressman, that he notified me, before he left an assignment 3 years ago. Let me give you the background, so there is no misunderstanding. We have what we call an orientation program. The men we recruit from the colleges, and the type of men that we want, we cannot always get off the civil service roster. Therefore, we have an understanding with civil service that we can take men under Schedule A within a period of 2 years, they will have to be assigned to the White House or dropped from the service. Now, in order to determine their ability and fitness for assignment, since some people are better criminal investigators than they are in protection work, we have an orientation program which includes duty on the White House detail. Bolden was one of the men selected to come in the summer of 1961. He was also a replacement for some regular agent on the detail who was on leave. It was a 30-day assignment. This afforded us an opportunity to observe him, determine whether he was equipped and so forth. And he was on the White House detail for this short period of time. The time that he describes was a 5-day weekend up in Hyannisport.
I don't think that quite answers, Mr.
I am giving the background. Mr. Rankin, I think the question is as to when you got the complaint. Mr. Rowley, well, excuse me. Continuing .1 before he left his detail assignment, you see, he alleges that he told me about the condition that was going on up in Hyannis. Representative Ford, before he left on this 30-day assignment? Mr. Rowley, when he left to return to his office in Chicago?
I don't think that quite answers, Mr. And what is the fact in that regard?
The fact is he never informed me. He never informed any of his supervisors or anyone on the detail. Mr. Rankin, I think the record should show, Mr. Chairman, that we were never advised that he wanted to testify, nor had we any inquiry or anything about Ney matter, until after we learned about it in the newspapers. Even then, he didn't ask to testify. And we asked the FBI to check into it, and he had counsel, and they refused to tell.
Folks, you just can't write this stuff. Stay tuned for the next episode where we dive deep into the internal investigation that the Secret Service conducted through Inspector McCann. And then after that, one more bonus episode dedicated to a bit more detail on Pat Kirkwood and the cellar. Thank you for listening to episode 200 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.